Thank you, Jorge. Thank you very much. And welcome in, everybody. It's lovely to be here. And I appreciate all of you taking time out of your schedule to join us today and come together in the Dharma. Today, we're going to speak about spiritual bypassing, and I'll get into more of that later. We'll start with about a 30-minute meditation, which I'll lead, and then I'll give a talk, and then we'll have time for Q&A. So if everyone can just find a position or posture that feels comfortable to you. Maybe it's sitting in a chair or lying down. Maybe it's standing. Maybe it's sitting cross-legged on the floor. Just find a position that feels sustainable and supportive and that meets the needs of your body in this moment. And as we get into our posture, it's important to sort of just check in with ourselves and notice what are the difficulties that my physicality is having right now. Is there a place where there might be some pain? Maybe there's a stiff muscle somewhere. I encourage you to just allow that experience. And just find a way to settle into your body. I invite you to notice a sensation, some sensual place of connection, whether it's something you see, something you smell, maybe it's the feel of the clothes on your skin, but some sensation. A place that you can continually return to as we get distracted by the world and our life around us. As thoughts come and go, and some we follow, just some place you can return to. Other people find their breath a great place of rest. But if you don't, just find a sensation, something that's steady and constant, something that is not needed to be controlled, but just you can bring your awareness to. And we slowly return to this sensation with gentle awareness. There's not a right or wrong way. There's not a right or wrong expression. And we're not trying to create some special experience. We just want to find a place that we can notice. This is my experience. Now, this is my experience. I want to recognize that minds were created to think. There's no such thing as getting rid of thought. We can allow it to not drag us around. We can just allow the thoughts to pass through without having to follow them. Just noticing, there's that thought again. There's that moment again. And then gently returning ourselves to the sensation, the place of rest place of ease. So we're settling into the physicality of our experience. But we're not looking at it through the lens of some specificity. We're not being specific. We're just trying to see, what's it like for me in this body right now? What's it like to be me? If I don't follow my thoughts, what's my experience then? Maybe as we settle into our experience, we begin to notice places of stuckness, places of blockage in our physical experience. Maybe we can bring some loving attention there. Maybe we can bring some spaciousness to that place in our body. Not to remedy, but just to notice, to give it attention. This is part of my experience. This pain, this tightness. The sensation may ease or it won't. Both are okay. Just return to our place of rest. Returning to that place of upright settledness. The place of ease, the place of inquiry. What's it like to be me? When I stop making opinions about something, about my thoughts or my sensations, but I just allow them. Who am I then? What's it like then? Buddhist practice is about returning to our own experience of this moment. This is why no one can do it for you, because it exists in your body, in your relationship to your own physicality. To your own willingness to be gentle with yourself and your experience. Maybe we notice a place of resistance. Can I meet that resistance with curiosity? What's it like to be me resisting? What happens to my mind and thoughts then? What happens to my body then? Do I notice the resistance in a particular place in my body? Can I allow myself to experience the resistance without an opinion about it, but to just notice? Can I start to pay attention to my experience and my thoughts without having to make an opinion about them, without having to fix them or overcome them or wrestle with them? As I begin to notice myself making opinions and judgments, can I just let them pass through me like any other thought? Opinions and judgments aren't a problem, and we don't have to attach to them, control them, or follow them. Just one more part of what it's like to be me in this moment, in this body, in this place, settled, supported, at ease. Can I notice my tendency towards leaning into the places of joy or ease or comfort? Can I let those pass by just as much as the places of suffering, the places of attachment, the places of resistance? Just trying to come into relationship with ourselves in a way that allows our experience to inform us that we can begin to see ourselves wholly with love and compassion. As we sit resting in this place of gentle attention, can I arise in myself compassion? See if I can notice where compassion lives in my body. Happens when I bring my intentionality to the generation of compassion. Can I begin to allow that compassion to have space in my body? I invite you to allow yourself to feel that compassion for yourself, for your physical experience, for your emotional experience, for your mental experience, for your historical experience. Bring compassion to the answer of what it's like to be you. Can I remain anchored in that place of ease and settledness, while also arising compassion? Can I stay connected to my physical experience, while also arising compassion? And as the compassion arises, may I open the compassion to places outside of my body, to the physical location, to this room in my home, to my home and all the people in it. Just allowing myself to stay connected to my physical experience. Staying in touch with myself while also bringing awareness and love and compassion to this home and the people in it. Continuing to allow the compassion to grow and expand staying connected with my physical moment of it, staying connected to my home and this place and the people in it. What happens when I allow it to grow into the street that I live, to my neighborhood, and to all the people in that neighborhood, whether housed or unhoused, the merchants, the neighbors I know and don't know, as we continue to grow the compassion emanating from our body, from our experience, from this physical form. We can notice that it takes over our entire town or city. Noticing what happens when I open myself up in this way. Can I stay connected to my physical, to the experience of myself, while also bringing love and compassion to everything around me? Just continually allowing that compassion to grow and expand. Until it takes up your entire country. And all the people in that country. To all the beings in that country. Whether large or small. Weak or strong. Allowing ourselves to continually stay connected to ourselves and expanding until the compassion is throughout the continent that we exist on. Can I begin to notice all the other people in the world who are experiencing and sharing compassion? Can I notice how the compassion that I'm bringing forth begins to merge with and join all the other people? So that I am now both giving and receiving compassion. Until I notice that the entire earth is covered in compassion, generated by millions and millions of beings, giving and receiving. Can I begin to then bring my attention back to my physical form to that sensation of ease and rest. Can I notice myself in this mandala? This web of compassion and connectedness. This web of interdependence, while also being individual, unique in my own physicality. I invite you to open your eyes. Look around. Maybe bring your hands and touch your physical form as we return our attention, not ending the compassion, but just noticing, oh, yes. Thank you all for your attention and willingness to join in me, join with me in this practice. So maybe you want to move just a little bit. Allow yourself to notice if something's fallen asleep during meditation. So I invite you to drink water. So again, my name is Daigon Gaither, and I'm coming to you from Ramatush Ohlone Land, also known as San Francisco. And I wanted to talk today a bit about spiritual bypass and what it is that what that is, but also how can I notice it? How can I begin to see my tendencies towards that? And what can I do when I notice that I'm engaged in that to sink into my experience? And spiritual bypass was created or described in the 1980s by a transpersonal psychotherapist named John Wellwood in his book, Towards the Psychology of Awakening. And in that book, he says that spiritual bypassing can be defined as a tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. I also notice in Buddhist circles that we also use this oftentimes, this dependence on spiritual ideas as a way to perpetuate places of oppression, whether it's the patriarchy, sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia. One of the first times I noticed this was being in a lecture hall with maybe 100 other people, and a teacher saying, oh, you know, that we saw them as a lesbian, we saw them as a woman, but they weren't really those things. That ultimately they had transcended those things. As a queer activist, I was visibly upset at that notion because I had spent a large portion of my life trying to come to terms with and revel in and enjoy being queer. And this sort of attempt at bypassing my individual experience really confused me and upset me. And then when I went to speak to the teacher after, I noticed that they were defensive and angry. And this was early in my Buddhist practice. This was, you know, early in the 2000s. I'd only been practicing about 8 years. And brand new to Zen. I practiced for a long time in the insight meditation or Vipassana tradition and found myself in Zen. And this is often the case in Buddhist circles. This is what we do. So it often is described as the two truths or the two realities. We have this conventional reality of our individual experience of the world, that we exist in this body, in this form, with all of its history, with all of its connections to ancestry, with all of the socializations. But then we also exist in this ultimate realm that simultaneously arising within this conventional is the ultimate, in which those delineators become unimportant, or they melt away and we are just one being. We're not part of a big whole. We're actually just a big whole. And the problem with this is that, one, we often view the ultimate as more important than the conventional, that we often view this transcendence into some experience of the ultimate as the be-all and end-all of our spiritual experience, of our spiritual practice, and maybe we even think of it as the goal. And that's actually missing this very important piece that arises simultaneously. Because if all we do is seek out the ultimate, we lose sight of and lose connection to this conventional. And when we begin to lose sight of this conventional, it's, one, it's traumatic, but also it's not possible because we exist in this physical form. Even the Buddha existed in a physical form. Even the Buddha did not, even though with all of the enlightenment, with all of his liberation, he still existed in this physical form, staying here to teach us. And so it's important for us to recognize that, one, what arises is arises simultaneously, that the ultimate is there, yes, but it arises simultaneous with this conventional, that we arise in each moment in connection with all of existence. And any experience that we can have of the ultimate is always going to be through the conventional. We can't experience ultimate reality without experiencing the convention of our own physical experience, our own individual life. I can't transcend anything until I come to terms with and at ease with the fact that I exist in this body and that nothing's broken here. That my experience of the world is just that. It's my experience of the world. Just like millions and millions of other human beings are having their experience of the world. Mine is socialized in particular kinds of ways based on the fact that I was born in a white family. I was born in a male body that was assigned male at birth, and that continues to be male, that I was socialized in particular kinds of ways, given that I was also born in the United States and the ways in which the cultural affectations of that influence my ability to exist outside of and relate to other people. And that's why with Buddhist practice, if you notice, almost all of us begin to draw our attention to the physical experience. When you're first given meditation instruction, we're told to focus on our breath and to bring our awareness to our physical experience of the world and to root ourselves there, to hold ourselves there. And I remember in 1995, when I first started practicing, this wonderful Dharma teacher, I was really suffering and I really wanted to not have the experience I was having. It was 1995 and the AIDS cocktail had just started to come out and I had lost two sets of friends to AIDS and I was grieving deeply and my community was grieving deeply. And a year earlier, my partner had died and I just couldn't, I basically couldn't function anymore. And so a friend and I began to seek out spiritual solutions, living in this place in California where everybody was having some access to, I mean, so much spirituality lives here. So we began to explore that. And I sat in a room with people practicing Buddhist meditation. And after the meditation, the teacher said, I don't remember anything else he said, but he basically said nothing was broken. And I had this visceral reaction. I could feel myself. One, I started to get nauseous and I felt like I needed to vomit. And then but I also was so enraged because that was not my experience of the world. I was broken. I was convinced of it. I had done therapy and I had done activism and I had done peer support groups and I had done all of the things and was still miserable and I was broken because nothing made it easy for me. And so I was also socialized to be a very good arguer. So I went I continued to go back to visit this guy because I wanted to understand enough that I could argue with him and explain to him how what he was saying was dangerous, wrong, and inappropriate. And this is 30 years later, and I still don't know enough to argue those things. And I've sort of started to see that I'm not broken and that no one is broken, that we're all having this human experience. And given the causes and conditions of my life up until that moment, up until this moment, how could I have the experience of the world in any other way than the way I was having it? Everything that brought me into that room, how could it possibly be any different? And this began to open up for me this idea and this understanding that maybe it's not about getting over something. Maybe it's not about getting over my grief, but how do I incorporate this? How do I make peace with this? How do I begin to find ease in my own physical, in this life, exactly as it is? And then I began to, so that's sort of the journey that my practice has been on for these 30 odd years is finding ways to notice what are the ways in which I think that my life is supposed to be different, that I feel like I'm broken, that I feel like I have to overcome something, that I have to make something go away. Because in all of the years that I've practiced, I have never had, I've had relief, I've had ease, I've had stability, I've had moments of clarity, but I've not been able to sustain that for longer than moments. And in Zen, we often say that, you know, there are no enlightened people, only enlightened moments. We also say that enlightenment is merely an appropriate response. And so I begin to practice in this way of like, well, what is an appropriate response? What happens when I move my focus from some kind of life that exists only in this ultimate experience. But I begin to notice that when I make appropriate responses in this moment, fully connected to this physicality, to this life that I have, I begin to make appropriate responses that don't harm other people and that don't harm myself. I begin to notice, oh, look, here's this place of commitment to patriarchy that was hidden from me, that was unclear to me. And I begin to notice, oh, wait, that doesn't actually serve any purpose for me right now. I need to try to practice new ways, try to develop a new response. Oh, look, here's this hidden bias I have around race. Can I begin to accept that I was socialized in these particular kinds of ways, given the causes and conditions of my experience up until this moment, and that I'm just now starting to notice, oh, wait, that's not how I want to be in the world. And so I begin to act differently. I begin to respond to moments differently. Sometimes it takes a little bit, and sometimes it doesn't. But so I get it right, and I get it wrong, and I, you know, 2 steps forward, 8 steps back, and I just keep doing this thing over and over and over again, this dance of what's it like to be me, and what's an appropriate response here? And that's how we begin. So we begin to notice spiritual bypassing, when we begin to notice the ways in which we hide ourselves from ourselves. Oh, I'm going to just, you know, I'm not really a white guy. I don't see color because color doesn't exist. And it's ultimately we're all one. And so I don't have to see color. Well, that doesn't really operate in the world in ways that don't harm other people. There's no separation between men and women because we're all ultimately the same gender and or without gender, and therefore, you know, worrying about gender becomes unimportant. Well, no, because, you know, one, I had to figure out whether the gender I was assigned at my birth was the gender that I actually was. What does that expression look like, and how do I want to be expressing that in the world with other humans? And so I begin to unpack and notice all of these ways that I have convinced myself, and even the practice of Buddhism, I can twist it in such a way that I begin to hide myself from myself and begin to hide others from myself. And when something's hidden, we can't be in intimate relationship with each other. We can't be friends with each other. We can't be lovers with each other. We can't truly support each other because we're hidden from each other. There's a wonderful old Chinese story where a student goes to his teacher and says, "What's the business under the robe?" Meaning, what's going on? What's this practice really all about? And the teacher only had one word response, which was intimacy. And I love that as a response because it's really this question of, can I develop intimacy with myself and with other people? Because ultimately, that's how we get through and past and beyond these ideas we make about things. How we begin to stop glossing over problems and situations, and we begin to truly connect and sustain and love each other. So in the blog post and in the sort of preparation up to this class, I asked everybody to sort of notice those places in your own experience when maybe you were trying to gloss over your experience, when you were trying to gloss over your interactions with each other, when maybe you were engaged in this act of spiritual bypass, and see if you can, one, do that without necessarily blaming yourself and thinking, oh man, I screwed that up and I need to go back and repeat, you know, whatever. like the ways we beat ourselves up, but can I just sink in and go, oh yeah, of course I did that. Okay. Let me, what do I need to do to fix that? How can I notice it? Can I catch it before I act on it? And just keep building on ourselves. Can I notice my own life? And can I notice how close or how far away I am from an appropriate response? And when I miss the mark, can I acknowledge that I missed the mark? Trying to make sure I don't miss any of the points that I wanted to make here. So in his book, Westwood says, to transcend something is to go beyond it to the point of ceasing to identify with it so that it becomes an object of our awareness. So we're not identifying with it, but we're still aware of it, right? When this process is healthy, what's been transcended is not excluded from our being any more than clouds are excluded from the sky, but rather is repositioned and related to in ways that serve our well-being. We begin to notice things like with my grief, I began to notice, oh my gosh, my connection to my grief, I can, when I reposition it, it becomes useful. It becomes a way for me to relate to people who are grieving and who are in moments of grief. And I became a hospice chaplain and I began to work with people who are in their grief. And because I've done my own work, I became less afraid of their grief. So I could fully join them in their experience and just say, hey, this is okay. This is part of our experience of the world. And this is new. And this is hard. And this is difficult. And we can do this. We're built for this. And we don't have to run away from it. Which, when I came into the rooms in the early 90s, that's not what I believed. I thought that somehow I needed to not grieve. That that's what it meant to be over it. That that's what healthy was. I no longer feel that way. I think that healthy is now fully experiencing whatever it is I'm feeling, whether it's my depression, my grief, my anger, my joy. And but in that expression, not being dragged around by it, not letting that decide my choices for me, but also not running away from it. Because in a way, denial and sort of hiding those things away is making choices for me. It's allowing those parts of myself that I don't like to make choices for me. And that moves me further and further and further away from an appropriate response. And the further I get away from an appropriate response, the further I get away from liberation. And also the further I get away from you. So I think that's a great place to end. And I would now like to invite you all, I'm going to open this up, and invite you all to ask questions, or you can make a comment. I believe that we are all already enlightened. I believe that there's wisdom that exists in this room that is not mine. And please feel free to ask questions in the box or come on screen. And thank you for that, Diane. It's always hard to be the first person to ask the question. Maybe somebody wants to join in, come on screen. Great question. So this question about What about working with anger and how to express this appropriately in ways that's not harmful to self or others? So I think it's really funny how there's so many places in which we think that or get taught that it's not okay to be angry. And yet, as a man, I was allowed and taught that I only got to have two emotions. I could either be joyful or I could be angry. And so for me, it was really important to begin to let myself, one, notice my anger, because some people are socialized not to be angry. So we have a variety of relationships to anger. But then in letting myself feel the anger, it also doesn't have to be fixed, right? Like, it doesn't need to be changed. It's not broken. Sometimes anger is an appropriate response. And then the question becomes, what's an appropriate response to my anger? Can I allow my anger without allowing it to drag me off into choices of behaviors that I don't necessarily think are conducive to building intimacy? And so the ways that I use anger to harm myself is often that I try to deny it or fix it or think that it needs to have some, because not all anger needs a response. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So the first part is to let it have its expression inside your own experience, right? Inside your own heart. And then to see what it needs, to let it tell you what it needs from you. Suzuki Roshi, and often in Japan, teachers often say that to train a horse, you give it a big pasture. And what I noticed for myself was that, you know, I would notice that when I got angry, my body would contract, right? And I would tighten up around it. And I would try to control it and, you know, shuffle it into things that I thought were right. Instead of, and when I notice that, can I just open myself up? Can I start to notice, where do I feel this in my body? What's it feel like? Can I come back to this wholehearted expression of, okay, I'm angry. Where is it? Not what is it? Not who is it? Where is it? Because it's my anger. And it doesn't really matter at this point who it's directed at. And once I start to allow it its full expression, then I begin to see the truth of it. Because sometimes I would use, because I was only trained to be angry or joyful, I would use anger to express frustration, or I would use anger to express hurt, or I would use anger to express my depression, or I would, so there were all these ways that I would use anger to cover up other things. So when I allow it its full expression, I begin to see what's underneath it. What else is there? And it's like, oh, wait, I'm just depressed, or I'm just hurt, or I'm just frustrated, or I'm frightened. And then I can respond to the frightened or the hurt or the frustrated or the depressed, which is what really needs to happen, right? I don't need the anger at that point when I can start to let myself feel a broad range of expressions of feelings. But I only can get in touch with that if I notice and bring myself into relationship to, like, oh, okay, so it's in my shoulders. Let me ease up on my shoulders. It's in my chest. Let me open up my chest. Oh, my stomach is in knots. Can I just bring some spaciousness there? Okay. Let my anger express itself. And then go from there. I hope that answered the question. Let me know if it didn't. I don't know the order in which this was handled, but I'll do the next one, which is, I often struggle with, on one hand, feeling meta and acceptance towards people who do not fully understand me, and on the other, having healthy boundaries and not allowing people who are not supportive to be in my life. I think that's an amazing thing. And I think that the more that we begin to notice the ways in which I don't accept myself, I don't understand myself. And also, I think sometimes, so if you notice when I was talking about the compassion practice, right, I didn't mention like being compassionate for the people that you were angry with or the people who were problematic for you or the people you were neutral with. I just opened it up geographically. And that's why I do that, because I think that we've built a meditation, a meta practice that's based on our relationship to people. And if I don't have a great relationship with myself, which sometimes, some days I do, some days I don't, I can't really get in touch with that. But I can get in touch with, let me just start from having compassion for myself and allowing that to fully engulf my body and then move it out from that. Because I think that that's what really is the purpose behind metta practice. So, and so maybe removing the specificity. And I'll tell you, I have very good boundaries. There are people in my life who I do not allow full access to my life because they've harmed me, because they continue to harm me. They continue to engage in violence against me. And that's my way of loving and protecting and taking care of this one, because that's got to come first. You know, and unfortunately, sometimes we hurt each other. And if people can't make genuine apologies for that, can't own up to that, can't engage with that, can't get into some restorative process with me about the ways in which they've harmed me, then I'm going to have boundaries. And that means I don't see people in my, like my family, for instance. I'm very controlled about how much time I spend with my family. And it's just because there's been enough experiences of unintentional harm and violence towards me. And I stopped wanting to fight about it. So I just started to make boundaries so that I didn't have to fight with them and I could enjoy our time together. And so that's what happens, right? And because it's also not a, like, I don't think people knowingly or willfully hurt each other. You know, we hurt each other because we're trying for power or we're trying for, like, I think it's a side product of things. So, yeah, boundaries are super important, and I totally encourage you to have them. And I hope that that answered the question. I don't like who I become around other people, which I frame as, yeah. So I'm an introvert who is very good at behaving in extroverted ways to protect myself. So so I understand this, right? And I think being able to start to look at what is it about the way I am around people that really upsets me? Is it that I don't feel like I maintain boundaries enough? Is it that I allow people to have too much influence or control over me? Is it that I don't express myself honestly with people? So begin to look at what is it that is the problem that about who you become around other people. Not from a judgmental place, not from a broken place, not from a place of like shaming ourselves, but from a real open-hearted, compassionate, like I said with the anger stuff, can I just notice like, oh yeah, and then allow myself to feel that and expand and give that a big pasture so that then it begins to tell me more about it. So I begin to understand it more, because then I can begin to I can begin to treat myself in better ways so that those things that frustrate me about being with other people aren't happening, right? So, yeah, I enjoy a solitary life. I need my downtime, and I don't think that that's also – I also don't think that that's a problem. I think understanding that some things are just like I process better when I have my alone time. And I still connect with people. I still am intimate with people. I still have my friends. I still have people in my life. And so, you know, it's not an either or. We don't have to engage in this either or thing, and we don't have to shame ourselves for it. But we can begin to look at, wow, what is it about my interactions that bother me about how I am in the world? Because ultimately that's the goal, is to be at peace and ease with how I am in the world. I want to be able to lay my head on my pillow at night and feel good about what I did that day. And what are the things that stop me from being able to do that? Because, you know, ultimately it's not about other people. It's about me. And it's about how I'm treating myself and how I'm treating and how I let that be influenced. If that didn't answer your question, you have more to say about that, feel free. Next we have I have a 94-year-old mother that struggles deeply with on and off and with depression, and how do I support her? And what I'll say about any way, it doesn't really matter. The best way to be supportive to people is to listen to them and be available to them, to be fully in them in that moment. But also recognize that no more than you want to be fixed or feel like you're broken, can I just be with them in a way that says to them, I love you, you're important, you matter, and you're not broken. This is just part of your life, and this is part of what it means to be in relationship with you, and I'm okay with that. And how can I express that to that person, right? How can I express to them that I'm okay with who they are? And, you know, my friends have learned that I suffer from on and off depression. Some of it sometimes is very chronic and I can't get myself out of bed. And my friends have just learned that if they don't try to fix me, if they just meet me where I am, and then, you know, they'll do things like, oh, okay, you've been in bed for 2 days now. I'm going to come over and cook you dinner. They're not saying, oh, let me know if I can do anything. They're saying, okay, you need to eat. That's part of the physical requirements of owning a body. So I'm going to come over and do that. And then they come over and do that, but they don't try to like fix me. They're just like, okay, come and eat what you can. And I'm going to make enough that you can, you know, nibble on it later. And then they're like, is it okay if I just sit here for a while with you? You can do whatever you're doing and I'm okay. Like if you want to sleep, sleep. If you want to just lay in bed, that's fine. I'm just going to be here. And I think sometimes that's the best we can do. And that's when we stop trying to fix it, when we stop making it a problem, oftentimes our relationships improve with other people. How do I respond skillfully and kind to people who use bypassing to justify unjust behavior? One, recognize that I engage in that bypassing to justify unjust behavior as well. That this is part of what it means being a person. And so if I cannot make them wrong, if I can meet them there wholeheartedly and just be like, hey, this feels a bit like this. And I notice when I'm engaged in this, that it sometimes can be harmful to my friends in this way. Rather than coming in with, you did this and this was, you know, like when I focus on the choices of behavior rather than their being, right? Like the difference between I have moments when I behave in racist ways to I'm a racist, right? So there's this difference. And the difference is that I don't have to be shamed for I made a bad choice here and I behaved in a way that was racist. I can actually own that and then go back and fix that, hopefully, or not, but at least apologize for it wholeheartedly. And then it's up to the person whether they accept the apology or not. But again, I think if we focus on recognizing that they're no different than us, that we do the same exact shit, and, you know, we're all just trying to get by. And so coming at it from that place of like, let's help each other, let's support each other, that's a much different expression and experience. And one that I think helps us meet other people, and actually then we begin to build relationships that are based on this allyship. Like, my world is now populated with people who tell me the truth about when I hurt them, and I'm able to tell the truth about when they hurt me. And when I fall short of the mark, I have people in my life who are able to say, hey, you know, that didn't seem like it was really what you wanted to do there. And, you know, let's maybe brainstorm about how we could maybe repair that and try something different. Right? So this place of also being curious, because ultimately that's how I want to be approached. Right? So if I stop thinking that it's only them doing it, but that I do this too, you know, there's a really great part of the Zen practice that says, you know, take the backward step and shine the light inward. What do I notice about my own expressions with that? Okay, so I was angry with I was angry with a friend and wrote to him stating the reason and asked him to apologize to me. Honestly, this act has two purposes. One, it is for him to know that he did something wrong that hurt your feelings, right? And it's also for me to stand up for myself. Beautiful, absolutely. So you didn't receive an apology. You are feeling better about it. So I think when we're in conflict with other people, oftentimes there's two ways that affects us. One is our own thing, right? Like you said, for you to stand up for yourself, for you to express, oh, this hurt my feelings, or this made me angry for this reason. Or, oh, I was really disappointed. I expected so much more from you. I don't understand how someone who says they love me can do that, blah, blah, like whatever it is, right? So we notice ourselves. So part of it is, and so that's part of the load that gets lifted. And honestly, when we just go to, it's the same thing with when I need to apologize to people. Sometimes people they're not going to respond in the ways that we want, or they're not going to accept our apologies, or they're not going to give us apologies. And I just kind of have to then decide, how do I have boundaries around that? And am I okay with that? Like, how do I maintain my own equilibrium and my own ability to be honest with myself about what's happening, so that I can continue to tell the truth to the people around me about how they are affecting me? And so, you know, like with my family, right? Like, rather than fight with them and argue with them and demand that they change, I just stopped. Like, I limit the amount of time, and I make sure that the time where we are together, and when I get frustrated, I take a break and I just walk away for a little bit and come back. And, you know, so it's about expressing. The most important piece is for me to express my own needs, wants, desires in that moment. And then I have to let go of the results and just allow whatever to happen. Okay, so I don't know which of these. Hopefully that answered the question. If not, let me know. So when I myself or other people don't acknowledge my experience, I don't feel seen. However, is there a way to bring attention to it without appearing to be attention-seeking? Yeah. one, I think getting rid of this judgment that calls it attention seeking, like that's just another way of shaming ourselves, right? Because the truth is human beings need attention. And I want it to, especially people who say they love me or I love, I want them to pay attention to me. And so I think it's okay to express our needs. And I don't know that that's attention seeking. I think that we've gotten trained to call it attention seeking because people are not comfortable hearing that we need something. People are not comfortable hearing us be very clear about what our expectations are in our relationships with them. And so, you know, we label it all of this stuff. Sometimes you have to walk away and, you know, I think that's what happens when we heal, right? As we begin to heal, we have to walk away from the people who can't heal with us, that can't support our healing, that can't support our continued sort of place of rest and ease and movement into our own experience of the world. And so, yeah, you have to walk away. And that's painful and that's hard. And sometimes it's really lonely. But understanding that if I just keep on my own healing, if I just keep doing what feels true and honest and real in my own experience of the world, that the people who can help with that, that move with me in the same kinds of ways, that will grow. So I just have to keep on keeping on, right? Knowing that the people who no longer can take advantage of you or, you know, all of the things in which used to happen before you started saying what you need, like they're going to leave and that's got to be okay. And it's a good thing because it also makes room for people who can support you. you know, like goodbye. See ya. I'm on my path. Okay. Let's see. Any tips on noticing when you're bypassing? This talks about we're all hardwired to bypass. Like, we don't like to look at the dark parts of ourselves, right? Like, it's hard work. It's painful. It means that you have to begin to build muscles that don't necessarily haven't been worked in a while. And but you just keep doing it and you keep getting better, right? So you can notice it I started to notice it after it happened, right? And sometimes it would be days or weeks after it happened. And then I started, you know, it slowly moved closer and closer and closer to the actual event when I could notice it. And sometimes I would have to stop myself in that moment and go, oh, wait, I'm totally bypassing here. Let me just stop for a minute, take a deep breath, come back to myself, and then change course. And every once in a while, I even get to before it happens. I begin to see it arising and I can go, oh, wait, I'm not going to head that direction because that's the bypass direction. I'm going to move over here. So it comes with practice, and the more that you do it with love and compassion and metta for yourself without judgment, and you just notice like, oh, yeah, I did that thing. Okay. Do I need to do anything to fix it? No. Okay, then I can try better next time, right? And that's how we move through those things. And it's hard work. Healing is painful, hard work, and it requires us to just keep trying over and over and over again. Yeah. I love this question. I'm always confused about saying what I need, want, against the backdrop of I should meet things as they are and just let others be who they are, even when it hurts me. Well, But if we don't express what our needs or wants are, how are people going to be able to be there and meet that if we don't give them the chance? Right? And so people are just going to keep doing what they do until we say, hey, could you maybe do this? Or that really hurts me. I'd appreciate it if we could do something else. You know, like if we, unless we begin to build that, people don't get a chance to be themselves either, because they're just going to act from their own habitual minds, right? And so, and any time that I find myself with the word should, it usually means I'm shaming myself or someone else. So it's much better for me to, if I could just sort of begin to recognize that my expressing my needs or my wants allows me to develop better relationships with people. My having boundaries allows me to have better relationships with people. And that allows me to meet things as they are. Because if I say to somebody, hey, I notice you do this to me, or you do this when we're around and it hurts me in this way. And if that person continues to do that repeatedly, then I know, like, okay, I'm going to need to let you leave. Because I've expressed what I need from you. You're not doing it. Time for you to go. And that's just how it is. And it's painful and it's hard and it sucks. And, but I won't know. I won't be able to get people out of my life unless I give them a chance to do better. And if I give them the chance to do better and they continue to not do better, then it's time to move them out. And that's the only way to express that. About letting go in meditation, I came to realize that I really did hurt a person actually several years ago, years after it happened. I still eventually called the person and apologized. I thought that, oh, it was so long ago, but the person did need that to be said. And we could continue our journeys. Exactly. That's such a beautiful moment, right? Like when you realize something, even if it's years later, and you realize, like, I want to be the kind of person who owns up to my harmful ways. I want to be the kind of person who can admit when I'm wrong. I want to be the kind of person who apologizes when I'm wrong. And I can let go of the results of what needs to happen when I do that. So, you know, I call the person and I apologize and I try to make amends, because that's part of an apology, is also to try and restore and make amends for, amend our relationship. So my apologies always include, one, this is how I'm going to be different, and also include, is there something you need from me? Is there something you need from me so that we can restore both of us to equilibrium? Doesn't mean that we're going to continue our relationship or our journey together. It does mean that we can both move forward. And so, yeah, whether it's years or decades, like, I want to be the kind of person who does that. So when those things come to mind, which they will, because, you know, some things are hidden from us for a period of time and then they pop up. And so that's just part of healing and growing and changing. And I think it's a beautiful way to operate in the world. And I hope that you continue to do that. Wanting to walk away from my sangha, I wonder if I'll be losing the connections that have developed yet. I also realize, as you did, you said, I will open up for other. So walking away from sanghas that are harmful is really important. And just because someplace is spiritual doesn't mean that it's helpful. You know, sanghas are groups of people, and groups of people do things that are not healthy or helpful or that are harmful. And so we need to leave them. And that's got to be okay. And I can make it about me, right? So when I moved out of the monastery, I recognized that I had done the work I needed to do in the monastery, and it was time for me to leave. And it wasn't about them. Like, I just was focused on, this is my practice. This is my sandbox. It's different than their sandbox. So I'm going to leave their sandbox and focus on what I do. What they do, up to them. Now, did they hurt me? Yes. And I don't have to blame them for that or shame them for that or disparage them. I can just keep the focus on this is what I'm doing in the world. This is who I am. This is how I want to be in the world. And this is my practice. They can do what they do. That's on them. And I have to say, I learned that because of when I was in seminary, I read a really great book called Bringing Zen Home by Dr. Paula Arai, in which she talks about the journey of Buddhist nuns in Japan. And that's exactly what Buddhist nuns have done for centuries. You know, they when you hear outsiders talk about Buddhist nuns' lives, you hear about the patriarchy and you hear about all the difficulties and blah, 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 blah. But when you listen to what nuns say about themselves, when you read their stories, when you read the Terigata, when you read what they say about themselves is they're focused on their own practice. They're not worried about the patriarchy. They're busy practicing. And it was such a learning experience for me to realize, like, oh, I can just focus there. So again, that book is Bringing Zen Home by Dr. Paula Arai, A-R-A-I. It's a brilliant book. She's a sociologist who teaches at Louisiana State University. And one of my favorite Buddhist teachers, even though she teaches all religions. I find myself to be at fault for wanting to what I do. It's painful. Yeah, like this is the thing, right? Like we think that wanting what we want is, especially if it's outside of accepted social norms, right? So when I teach about sexuality, one of the things I say often is that there's nothing out that you could desire or want that is consensual, that's outside of Buddhist teachings. So, you know, polyamory, SM, pornography, all of those things are not necessarily outside of the realm of Buddhist teachings. And the same thing is true for wanting what we want. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be outside of the teachings. It doesn't necessarily have to be bad. And I think that we can definitely spend some time recognizing that we're shaming ourselves for wanting what we want. So I think it's great if you can begin to give yourself some expansion to that. Give yourself some room for that. Can I just open myself up to wanting what I want? And then finding out how does that need to be expressed or how does that need to be responded to that is in accord with how I want to be in the world? Because that's the most important piece. And I hope that that helped. You can also contact me through my website if you have more questions. There's a contact page on there. I'm really happy to answer your questions. I want to say really quickly before we go that Dana is the practice of supporting livelihood. It's not about it's not about in the same kind of way that some religions say you're expected to donate. What this is I don't charge for anything that I do. It's a way to break out of the racist capitalist system. And for us to say, what you do is important to me, and I'm going to support that. And it's also a way for you to tell me whether or not what I'm doing is beneficial and helpful. Because when I stop losing support of the Sangha, it tells me something, right? And I need to make adjustments. So it's this reciprocal relationship. And everybody's invited to give according to their means, whatever those means are. There's no expectation that anyone will donate anything, but give according to your means. If it's 50 cents, give 50 cents. If it's $500, give $500. But just the idea is to give something, and that includes if all you can give is a blessing, is a moment of loving thought to someone, to an organization, to an institution. Maybe it's, you know, spreading the word about their work or whatever. Like, there's other things that you can give that aren't necessarily financially. So please give what you can, how you can, and in accordance with what is beneficial for you and for us. So thank you all very much. I really appreciate your practice. I appreciate all of you. I'm really grateful that I have this platform and I'm allowed to sit and be with everyone in this way. And thank you.